So with that, we're going to talk about the implementation update of our joint lease standard. And first on to tee it up will be Chris Roberge. I see Chris on the screen.
Yeah, I'm here. Thank you, Rich. So if we work through the paper, which I believe is A, we are in we're in the process of our post implementation review of leases. That is to evaluate whether the standard is achieving its objective, and we're in we've been in stage one, you know, really since the standard was issued in 2016. So we're monitoring the implementation and the application of the standard. We want the next page just to give you an implementation update. As you can see, since 2016, we've had a host of board meetings to keep the board up to date in how the standard is being applied and if there are issues that need to be addressed. There's been seven standard setting five final updates that the board issued between 2018 and 2020. So we've had a lot of work that we've done on this to really either simplify or clarify the standard. As part of the PIR process, we've been doing a lot of outreach with all types of stakeholders, particularly in the last year with preparers, audit firms, and most recently we had a significant amount of outreach with users. And as you probably know, we held the roundtable in September, which we'll talk a little bit more at the end of the slides. And we plan to bring that feedback back to the board in a meeting next month on December the 2nd. To get direction from the board as to, you know, where we want to go next. But as part of our outreach efforts and before the board meeting, or before the leases roundtable that was held in July, the board added a project to its agenda to address issues for which we thought that we had sufficient information from stakeholders. The first one, which I'll talk about, was an agenda request received on sales type leases that included variable lease payments. The issue was that because there's variable lease payments are not included in the net investment in the lease, there was a day one loss being recognized for certain sales type leases for arrangements for which the lessor expected it to be overall profitable. So as the board thought about this and we went through this, the board decided to propose guidance where a lessor be required to classify a lease with lease payments that are predominantly variable as an operating lease. This answer gets to an answer we believe is more consistent with what you would get if you were applying the lessor guidance under IFRS 16. We received through our outreach, we received an informal request from a large preparer group to address the remeasurement of lease payments based on a reference index or rate. As you know, remeasurement is required under IFRS 616. The current concern was is that you have large multinationals who file under both US GAAP and IFRS 616, it is costly for them to maintain two sets of books. So they asked for an option that's consistent with the requirement in IFRS 16 to remeasure the lease liability upon change in a reference index or rate that affects future lease payments. The board did decide to expose that as well on the basis that it provides the most up-to-date cash flow information. And as part of our user outreach, where we have asked users whether they are concerned because it is an option with lack of comparability. Lastly, as far as the lease modification guidance, we learned also through our outreach that there is some cost and complexity when you have a reduction in scope of a lease contract, such as the termination of a lease within a master lease contract, where the economics of the remaining leases in that arrangement remain the same as before the termination, and that applying modification account counting, and this is for both lessee and lessor, which would include reconsidering classification, the fair value of the underlying asset, discount rate, and so forth, that may not be necessary, and that you would that a lessee or lessor would continue to account for the remaining leases as it would before the partial termination. The board agreed and issued guidance to proposed guidance to clarify how to account for that. If we move on, again, as part of our PIR, we held a roundtable on September the 18th, where we selected broad top topics to discuss, which were identified in advance through all of our outreach, and really were areas, for the most part, where we had learned that there was cost and complexity associated with the implementation of the standard. So we had obviously the FASB board staff and 21 diverse stakeholders, which included financial statement users, public preparers, private preparers, some industry reps and practitioners. So the items that we discussed, first was an agenda request that was around for a while, which was whether the board should clarify the guidance around the lessee use of the rate implicit in the lease, that is to determining to clarify when that rate is readily determinable, and when it can be applied. Staff outreach and discussion at the roundtable indicated that this was not a pervasive issue, that practice is equal to apply the guidance consistently. And really, for the most part, the default is to the incremental borrowing rate, except in certain circumstances where the rate is known. And therefore, in October, the board decided not to add a project to address this. the board at the roundtable, the application of incremental borrowing rate was discussed, and some of the difficulties and complexities encountered as a result of really more leases being on book right now, and therefore more scrutiny of the rate, as well as that it's now a collateralized rate. There was some alternatives that were thrown out by the staff, such as, you know, can we provide a specific rate to be used across the board to reduce the cost of applying it. But at least the feedback from the public preparers was that, yeah, that they went through it. It was hard there, but that there are processes in place and that they are able to repeat these processes and determine the rate implicit in the lease. We discussed more broadly the lease modification model, knowing that the board was going to expose guidance on the reduction in scope. There was discussion about perhaps re-looking at the modification more broadly, the model more broadly, to deal with things such as minor modifications and whether the lease modification guidance would have to be applied then, and some outcomes that occur that may not make economic sense based on the guidance, because the guidance is a prospective model. So you know treat a change for the most part as if it's a new lease. We discussed embedded leases and the identification of leases in non-lease contracts, such as service contracts. We did note, you know, that the definition of a lease did not really change significantly from what was under prior GAAP, but because more leases are on book, you know, there was a lot more scrutiny in identifying the leases. There was some discussion at the roundtable about the low value asset exception that's in IFRS 16, and whether we should extend that as well. And then lastly, we discussed the guidance around lessee allocation of payments and the complexities and sometimes outcomes that may not represent the economics of the arrangement when fixed and variable payments exist in conjunction with lease and non-lease components. So I'll stop there. Hopefully I stayed within my time. And
yeah, you did, Chris. Thanks very much. Okay. Now let me turn it over to Petrina, who's going to give us the IFRS update.
Thank you, Rich, and thank you, Chris. So I'm going to talk to Agenda Paper 12 B now, and again, like Chris, just provide you with an update really on any activities to do with leases at the ISB or at the foundation over the last year. Now, unlike what's happening at the FASB, we haven't yet started our post-implementation review of IFRS 16. So I think our activities reflect the fact that we're in a period of being responsive to questions if they're asked of us, but we're not actually actively seeking input on the standard at this stage. So maybe if I turn to slide 5 in that paper and just mention, first of all, some of the more recent application questions that we have received and that has been discussed by the Interpretations Committee. in the past year. Now, just to be clear, what you see on this slide are just those where the committee sort of published an agenda decision or tentative agenda decision in the last year. We did have some other questions on leases that came into the committee earlier in 2019. And where the committee did respond again in an agenda decision, but those are not mentioned here. And I suppose more generally, I would say that if you look at sort of the questions we've had around leases, they've probably gone from being sort of earlier back in 2019 and the earlier part of this year being more on questions on maybe what I'll call the more general parts of the standard that apply to all leases. And now they've moved to kind of more specific transactions, and in particularly more recently, we've had a few questions on sale and leaseback transactions. On this slide, you can see there's a couple of agenda decisions mentioned that we have out on lease term and the definition of a lease. Those questions are actually on requirements where we have the same or similar requirements in IFRS 16 and Topic 842. And at least from discussions with Chris and his team, I think the conclusions reached in those agenda decisions, they would very much align with what we'd expect the outcomes to be when entities apply US GAAP as well. Now, if I move on then to sale and leaseback transactions and I look at sort of slide six, I will talk through this. I will just mention it briefly, however, because I will say that the questions we've had on sale and leaseback transactions are actually specific to IFRS 16. Sale and leaseback is an area where IFRS 16 and Topic 842 don't have the same requirements, and actually the questions we've had are specific to the requirements in IFRS 16. So maybe first of all, just looking at slide six, I'll explain first of all, well, what does IFRS 16 say about sale and leaseback transactions? So first of all, if the transaction actually qualifies to be treated as a sale, then a seller lessee would derecognize the asset sold and then, of course, recognize the right of use asset that arrives from the leaseback. But the measurement of the right of use asset is actually based on, it's a proportion of the previous carrying amount, and that drives the sort of recognition of the gain or loss in the transaction. And it means that any gain or loss recognized on the transaction actually just relates to the rights transferred to the buyer lessor. There's no recognition of any sort of gain that might relate to the rights that the seller lessee retains. Now, what that means overall is for example, if I sold a building and leased it back for, say, 20 years for almost all of the sort of economic life of that asset, then I'd expect to recognize little, if any, gain on the transaction, because economically I'm in a very similar position before and after the transaction, because I'll continue to lease and control the use of that asset for the next 20 years. But if, in contrast, I say sold that building and lease it back for, say, only 3 years, then I'd recognise a very significant proportion of any overall gain embedded in that sale because I've transferred the vast majority of the rights and I've just retained a right to use the building for 3 years. So that all sort of, works well in a sense, and there's requirements in IFRS 16 to cover that. And particularly, we haven't had any questions in the context of where the payments, the leaseback payments, are fixed or otherwise meet the definition of lease payments. However, the question that we did get into the committee was in a scenario where the leaseback payments include variable payments that don't meet the definition of lease payments. And I suppose in the extreme, the question was, if all of the leaseback payments were actually, variable, were 100% variable, would you end up having a right of use asset and a lease liability that are zero? And could you end up recognising the full gain on the transaction in that case? So as I say, slide seven just sets out an example that illustrates, I suppose, the committee's conclusion. The committee said there, first of all, that they think the requirements in IFRS 16 are sufficient, in a sense, to tell entities how to do that accounting at the commencement date. And so the agenda decision explains that and includes an example along the lines of what's in slide seven. However, what that discussion identified was that there is a question about subsequent measurement. And that's really because IFRS 16 only includes sale and leaseback requirements that cover what happens at the commencement date. There isn't actually any specific requirements in the standard to tell you what to do when you're subsequently measuring, in particular, the liability that arises in this transaction. And so slide 9 in the deck just explains that the outcome of that discussion is the board has now decided a narrow scope project, and where the board is very close to publishing an exposure draft that would actually propose to add some requirements to IFRS 16 to specify in particular how to do the subsequent measurement of the lease liability that arises from that transaction. Just to say, that project is very, very much narrow scope, but it's only going to propose requirements for sale and leaseback transactions, and we'd expect the effect really to just be for sale and leaseback transactions that include these types of variable payments that don't meet the definition of lease payments. So with that, that was all I was planning to say in the update. What we've done is the questions for both boards across sort of papers 12A and 12B are included on page 10 or on slide 10 of agenda paper 12B. And we just have a couple of questions asking if board members would like any additional information about the activities of either board, or if you have any other comments on those activities.
Okay, thank you, Petrina. So I'd propose we take both these questions together. So any comments or any questions any of the board members would like to make? Okay, Jin Chao.
Thank you. Also thanks, Chris, a very good update. And I also appreciate that it seems that some changes you are going to make actually will align with your requirement to IFRS 16. That is very, very good. I just have a question about or further information about the remeasurement of lease payment based on the reference to the reference index or rate. The proposal you are giving is to give an option to preparers. So that is optional choice for companies. And during this process, you also engage with, you know, stakeholders and the users and other stakeholders. I wonder whether you have heard any compatibility concerns regarding this optional choice provided to the companies rather than just the one, you know, accounting policy available for companies. Thank you.
Sure. I mean, whatever we provide an option, there is concern with lack of comparability between those that elected and those that don't. We would hope that the information would be comparable amongst multinationals, and we noted that or think that it provides the IFRS 16 way provides the most up-to-date cash flow information, that is to remeasure. All that being said, during our outreach we have asked the questions of if users are concerned with this option. We've got mixed feedback on it, but I think you have to weigh that off with which information is more useful. So, but we are asking the question.
Thank you.
Okay, next we have Anne.
Thanks, Rick. My question's for Chris as well. Chris, it's a question about the cost-benefit trade-off. So when I look at slide 3, subsequent to issuing the standard, the board made quite a series of changes. And I'm just wondering if you can help us understand the cost-benefit trade-off, because many times we hear that people don't want the standards changed after they're issued because they want to be able to implement them and get to understand them. So what sort of feedback were you hearing that encouraged you to make these changes as you did? Obviously, the board decided the benefit would be greater than the cost. But I wonder if you could give me a bit of background on that. Thank you.
Sure. And there's a whole host of top topics that the board addressed between 2018 and 2020. We did consider a lot of costs. So I'll take two of the major changes. One was to transition. So where we provided an alternative transition method whereby entities could recognize the cumulative effect catch within the year that they adopt, as opposed to in the earliest period presented. But in doing so, to not lose all of the information, the board decided to continue to require the 840 disclosures be kept in the statements for the comparables. And really that was a weight of there was just so much cost in applying the transition requirements that it was perhaps going to cause companies significant complexity in applying the standard as of the effective date. We also did some changes to the lessor guidance to really bring it back to what the old guidance was, because the board's intention really was not to change the lessor guidance. So we did consider it, and obviously very, very concerned of if there was an effect on the decision usefulness. But ultimately, we felt that the reduction in costs justified the changes.
Thanks, Chris. And maybe I could just add a couple things. As under USGAAP, we had a phased implementation between the large public and then the second phase being the smaller public and private entities. So part of what we committed to do was make improvements prior to that second wave of adoption. And obviously, to the extent we removed cost and complexity or answered unanswered questions, those were a lot easier changes to make. In that period, I would say our stakeholders had more appetite for those changes than if we were imposing additional cost and complexity on. So I think that probably had some factor in it too. I think next up was Rika.
Thank you, Rich. I have a question about the part stakeholder feedback you about the embedded lease at the in the key round table. And because when remembering the implementation of the new lease standards, the issue of the embedded lease can be maybe major problems will be three. Like firstly, the identification as shown on this slide, like how to separate non-lease and lease component. And the second question will be allocation of consideration to each component. And the third one will be considering the accounting data side, classification of operating and financing might be also issue. So when you had concerns or feedback from the stakeholder, their concern, the feedback of mainly focus on identification of the lease within the embedded lease contract.
I mean, that really was the that really was the concern because of the scrutiny on more leases coming on book. What we learned about the allocation and what the board did provide is that there is a practical expedient to combine lease and non-lease components and account for the entire component as a lease, and therefore that takes, you know, some of the costs and complexity of applying the guidance away, and the expectation is for when, you know, you have what we'll call large lease and small non-lease, our understanding is that many lessees have used that practical expedient. So
I see. Understand. Thank you very much.
Okay. And then I think our final question is to Doug.
Thank you, Rich. It's a quick one. It's in relation to the reduction of scope in a lease contract. You mentioned the separate lease component. I'm just wondering whether the separate lease component could be a proportion of a single contract. For example, 50% of a contract could be considered a separate lease component in these circumstances.
So it's funny you asked that. We actually had a call, someone who is going to comment to the proposal asked that same thing to our team last night. What we address in this is the term termination of the entire lease. So if I think what you may be referring to is if I conclude that I have a single lease component and it's 10,000 square feet and I reduce it to 5,000 square feet, but I still say that at lease commencement, that was just one lease component. Does our proposal address that? And it does not. Now, what it would make you ask is that was there really multiple lease components at lease commencement because you were able to reduce the space and still use it and have the space that you're going to terminate be used by someone else or for something else. But yes, it's a great question.
Okay. And Jim, I got the impression you wanted, by two hands up, jump in on response to that, and then I have Sue next. You're on mute, Jim.
So, yeah, I did want to respond to that because I think, you know, maybe technically you could say, well, if it's not a separate lease component, it's not in scope, but I don't think most people, if you lease 10,000 square feet of space, are actually considering whether they have separate lease components. There's no need to. If it's just 10,000, you know, contiguous square feet of space, why would you think about whether I have one lease component or 10,000 lease components? And so I think reducing that, you would arguably say, well, of course I have separate lease components. I just separated them. By canceling half of the lease, I made clear that I can separate this component from that component. And so I think it's going to cause people to say, yes, in fact, there was no need to identify the components, but when I reduce the scope, it's always demonstrative of separate lease components, or almost always demonstrative of separate lease components.
Okay. Christine, I guess you want to jump in on the exact same point. Sorry, Sue, I'll be right with you.
Thanks, Rich. So I guess the question I have for Chris is kind of on that point, and just has there been discussion about how easy the separation is in this respect? So what I'm thinking of is if you have a situation where you've got 10,000 square feet, And you have to build walls in order to hive off a portion versus just, you know, you're eliminating a portion of the lease. I'm just wondering if that issue has come up in the context of whether it was separable at the beginning or not.
Yeah, I mean, that's the tough question. We have an example in our guidance, I believe it's example 18, where there's a reduction of square footage, and the example shows how to account for it as if none, regardless of the fact that there was a reduction, that it's still accounted for as a single lease component. So I think it's facts and circumstances. I think, you know, depending on how much work that you have to do to separate them, how much cost that you incur and so forth. But I take Jim's point. I mean, if you reduce and there's not a lot of cost in doing so, I don't see how you don't have multiple lease components. So, but it's a tough question. I wish I had the silver bullet on that one, but.
Thanks, Chris. Sue?
I was gonna take us back to a 30,000 feet level comment. Just to say that, you know, every time we get a question on IFRS 16 or have a discussion with the firms or preparers, almost the first question they ask us is, have you spoken to the FASB? And so I just wanted to say that I think it's fantastic that there is good dialogue between the staff teams on this, so that we can both say, sort of from an optics perspective, yes, with assurance in response to that question, but also to make sure that we are sharing information. And it's a little bit tricky with this one because there's lots of commonality between our two sets of literature, but also sort of subtleties that are different as well. But, you know, just well done to Chris and Petrina and those that they work with for making sure that that dialogue is happening, because I think it's really important to try and maintain commonality wherever we can. It's after all the hard work we did over the years discussing this topic. So good job.
Great. Thanks, Sue. And I would echo those comments. So with that, I think I'm going to take us into our break. Now, it was supposed to be 15 minutes, but because I did not do as good a job as Sue, I think I've shortened it a little bit. So for those in London, I think the plan is to come back at 14:10 and in the US at 9:10. Does that work for everyone? Okay, very good. What I would suggest is you can shut off your, make sure you're on mute, and you can shut off your video if you would like. All right, thanks very much. See you in a few minutes.